She won't ask for it.
Okay, good morning, and welcome back to lecture two in this year's Hinshelwood lecture series. No more introduction from me, so we'll move straight into the talk, which hasn't changed. It's Rational Design Complex 3D Microarchitectures. Joanne.
Thank you so much. I didn't finish last time everything I wanted to say, so I'll come back a little bit because there is something that I want to convey, and we'll see if I will be successful in terms of what does it mean if you build a system, if you build it hierarchically, if you combine many different features in one system and emergence of new behaviors and new things that can come from that. So overall, what we started to talk about is whether we can use bi-inspired approach for inorganic crystal engineering. And the lesson, the first one that we were discussing, is that in nature, there are organic surfaces, whether cells, vesicles, or proteins, that control the formation of any crystals, but in particular, inorganic crystals. The system that I have chosen to demonstrate that is calcium carbonate growth. It's most abundant mineral that is used by organisms as a skeletal material, but it's actually extremely abundant in many other places. We have calcite crystals, for example, in our ears that define your balance system. And I started with putting together this wish list and trying to see whether we can go through it. And the first one that I tried to address was whether we can think about controlling crystal orientation in space, because all biological crystals, or at least majority of them, they're highly optically, some of them optically active, but they're all crystallographically oriented in certain ways. It sometimes gives them better mechanical properties. In other cases, it gives them optical properties. And I mentioned this wonderful skeletal element that is coated with lenses. And all these calcitic lenses are oriented along the optical axis so that birefringence is controlled. Overall lesson that I wanted to convey, and very counterintuitive lesson, was that it's not the epitaxy. It's not the lattice match between the growing crystal and the underlying organic crystal that templates it. It's not the epitaxy that controls the orientation of crystal. It's what we call stereochemical recognition at the, in this case, at the organic-inorganic interface. And in particular, that in, if we think about organic template, for example, self-assembled monolayer, that is functionalized in an interesting way to match certain features in the growing crystal, then this match, and in most cases where orientation takes place, the crystal would look at that layer as its own surrogate interface with exactly the same orientation that continues in this space. That's a counterintuitive approach, because most crystal growth is defined by epitaxia, by epitaxial match between the substrate that you use and the crystals that grow then on its surface. There's actually some interesting thing that one can come back to biological system and get a lesson now from growing crystal in synthetic systems. There's something that we can, we hope, we can explain in biology. For example, if in different biological systems, crystals are grown, same crystals, for example, calcite, are grown in different crystallographic orientations, you actually do not need a different protein or a different organic molecule to control its orientation. It is simply possible to think about a same protein or the same organic molecule that just tilts in a different way, orients functional groups that are involved in the nucleation of these crystals. And this change in the orientation of these functional groups, for example, carboxylic acids on protein structures, would be enough to induce a different orientation of crystals. So they're a really interesting lesson, but it's orientation that is translated through the interface. How about epitaxy? We also mentioned that if there is a lattice mismatch, orientation is matched, but epitaxially, crystal and the underlying substrate create a strain. They're mismatched. There is something that it translates into the crystal that will grow. Not the orientation, but somewhat deformed crystal shapes. In particular, if we look at the differences in the strain in different crystallographic directions, here is a schematic, just simple schematic, one can say that the growth rate of the crystal along the direction where the strain is reduced is much faster than in the opposite direction. So even, let's say, if the crystal was supposed to be purely cubic, it would actually elongate in the direction where mismatches is reduced, and we'll have to pay in energy to continue growing in perpendicular direction. So there is an interesting thing related to changes of the crystal shape. Now, if we think about mechanism, so what is the mechanism? And of course, we can calculate the energetics of this interface. If we think about epitaxy, which we know not the case, then the trade-off here is that it's perfectly aligned with underlying substrate, but orientation of these functional groups, shown here for self-assembled monolayer in something like red and green for anions in the crystal structure, that mismatch is costly. So that we do know it's not happening. The other thing is, which we do know is happening, is that the orientation of these functional groups, and now I put red and green parallel to each other, is the same, but there is epitaxial mismatch. It's also costly, because now this unit cell is different from the underlying unit cell, and that energetically would also have to manifest itself. So there are yet another mechanism to consider would be organic molecules, in particular self-assembled monolayers, are quite soft. They're not inorganic crystals, so there might be a possibility to combine both so that there is orientational match and also lattice match. However, that you need to then bend the monolayer significantly beyond a very small size of the nucleus that may grow on that. What actually happens is indeed is the third mechanism, but a little bit in a different way. When we measure the size of the domains in the monolayer and the strain at the interface, it's actually both orientational match and epitaxial match, but the formation is some domains where the monolayer can bend without paying too much energy for that bending, and then skipping a couple of unit cells and then conforming to the crystal again. So we also started to discuss how to change morphology, and the simple lesson that one can get is that there are crystal growth modifiers, whether it's junk in biological system or whether they actually have a function. I don't want to discuss at this moment, but it's obvious that in nature, it's not only that the crystals are growing in pure solutions. There is always something else, proteins, polysaccharides, or simply, in case of calcium carbonate, mostly in seawater, huge amounts of magnesium. So let's say what is happening in this case. Again, I was trying to show you that if there is a certain specific crystal shape that is supposed to develop due to packing and energy of different directions in the crystal, but if now you would have a specific additive shown here in yellow that only interacts with a certain crystallographic direction but not others. So this attachment poisons crystals in some way, and it reduces the growth rate in the direction perpendicular to the plane to which additives are attached. So there would be change in the crystal shape that result from that. There is another feature that I mentioned before, is the fact that now you have some of these molecules, especially polymeric molecules, within the crystals. Their mechanical properties improve significantly. And in particular, that is one of the reasons that calcite, which is extremely brittle material, is in fact used by organisms for skeletal production and for the material that is supposed to be strong. So in one can look at that in such a way that if we look at the cleavage planes of calcite that form about 45 degrees with the C-axis of calcite, and if the proteins are oriented parallel to C-axis or perpendicular to C-axis, they actually form about 45 degrees with the cleavage planes, and they act as really crack-stopping mechanism because energy will dissipate at these intracrystalline molecules. But let's go back to magnesium. I don't want to talk about proteins anymore. I showed you some examples, but proteins are a pretty difficult system. We don't know exactly what is their conformation inside the crystal. But even talking about magnesium and growth of crystals in the presence of magnesium gives you something interesting. And what I want to do now is to put two control systems. First, I would look at the system where you have magnesium and calcium, but no self-assembled monolayer. It's a mess there, but there is a common feature in all these crystals. Magnesium has the specific effect in the along the HK0 facets of calcite. So the crystals lose their facets in this direction and become a little bit elongated in C-axis direction. But if you look here, this crystal is highly elongated. This one a little bit affected. You could see these dirty facets forming. They're all completely different sizes. They're all having certain effect of magnesium affecting calcite in the specific direction, but not uniformly in all crystals. Let me give you another control. And this is no magnesium at this case, but I do use self-assembled monolayer, in this case, carboxylic acid terminated self-assembled monolayer supported on silver surface. Doesn't matter what I use, but I have chosen that as an example. What we know that all crystals are highly crystallographically oriented. They all grow from O12 plane. We discussed that there is a match between them, but look at these crystals. And graph A here corresponds to the distribution of crystal sizes that grow on the self-assembled monolayer. They're all crystallographically oriented. They're all thin in the C-axis direction due to the lattice mismatch in this direction, but they're all different sizes, completely different sizes. So what happens if I now combine that? And what I want to say is that one specific parameter may give you some ideas, but combination of two, and nature uses a lot of that, not just these two, also confinement, and I will get to confinement very shortly, gives you something interesting, gives you additional property. So here is an example of the mixture of magnesium and calcium with self-assembled monolayer. And suddenly what we see, first of all the crystals now begin to develop these new facets to which magnesium attaches and the calcite changes its shape. So this specific one is the D. Look at narrow distribution of crystal sizes. All crystals are exactly the same in terms of size and shape. I can go further. You could still see a little bit of 1 of 4 cleavage planes, but these are new facets that due to the interaction with magnesium. Not only that, C-axis direction is the same here in here. These crystals elongate perpendicular to C-axis direction. These ones now, due to magnesium effect, become highly elongated along the C-axis direction. I can add a little bit more magnesium, and there is no memory of 1 of 4 cleavage planes anymore, and you get even narrower size distribution, and all the crystals are crystallographically oriented but a completely different shape. And the add-on feature is that we now have highly oriented growth with uniform size distribution, change in the shape, highly uniform change in the shape, by just adding an additive plus using substrate that controls the orientation. And very simple way to explain it, of course, we can also do the math and calculate that, is let's imagine that the crystals can grow. The crystal grows, let's take something like that. This is a crystal. And there is an additive that only interacts with that surface of the crystal. So now, if you don't have oriented crystals, so the crystals can be oriented on the surface in many different ways. So availability of the surface to which specific interaction is directed is different. So diffusion to this place, especially if this facet is now hidden by interaction with the substrate. So whether it is fully up or sideways would define to which extent the additive will have the ability to interact with this growing crystal. Now, the moment they're all oriented, whichever the orientation, all the crystals are now sitting exactly with the same availability of the plane and the surface that the additive recognizes. It means its attack to this face is exactly the same. It means they would be affected to the same extent, and that brings you uniformity in shape, in size, and crystal orientation. And in fact, depending now, same magnesium additive, but depending whether my crystal, due to the self-assembled monolayer, was growing upwards, sideways, or depending on the availability of these planes, you can now get whole range of completely differently shaped crystals. And here is a couple of examples of growing them on carboxylic acid terminated surface on gold, gives you crystals of that shape. On silver, on gold but with a different sulfonated surface, on OH terminated surface, almost spherical crystals, and even interesting shapes as dumbbells, again, as a result of preferred interaction of the crystal with a certain additive on the highly oriented crystal surface. So there is interesting things that we can do when now we combine two approaches, oriented growth and additives in a system. But let's go further and get to yet another topic and think about pattern crystallization. Again, I'll try to come to nature for most interesting systems that can help us understand the beauty of this approach and structures that nature evolved. So these beautiful hats, and there is many more, different species of coccoliths create different hats. I don't know why they're obsessed with hats. So all holococcoliths, many hundreds, thousands of species, would create a different hat. The hat, it's the skeleton of this organism, is composed of calcite crystals, but all these calcite crystals are, first, exactly the same size, we were talking about size, B, exactly the same crystallographic orientation. You see that they're all parallel to each other. This is different orientation here, same crystal, but they're positioned in space. So what is it that we can potentially learn from nature? Again, as simple as possible. I have a problem with complexity. So I'll show you here two examples of growth in natural system and then in artificial, but with biological calcite crystals involved. So the first one shows the growth of sponge spicules, calcareous sponge spicules, in the ocean, where to the place where they were growing, calcium marker was added. And it shows that these crystals do not grow uniformly everywhere. There are certain sites whether they make the crystals more, maybe a self-healing of the crystal, or it will grow only at the tip, but nothing, no growth takes place somewhere else. So it's very localized somehow. Yet another example of an experiment that I mentioned you here before in the relationship of crystallographic orientation of this plate on brittle stars. It's a beautiful experiment. I have high school students in my group. They all love to do this experiment. It's very simple. You take biological crystal and you use it as a template. You just put calcium solution, wait for CO2 to diffuse in, and on top of this biological substrate, new crystals would grow. But look here. They grow only in certain locations, but not everywhere on the underlying biological crystals. There is something about microenvironment. There is something about control of the nucleation site. It's not taking place uniformly in bulk. So what can we do here? So what if we think now that if I would somehow label a place where nucleation should take place, maybe we will be able to create these nicely ordered arrays of crystals. Now, self-assembled monolayers on metals is a wonderful system because in the group of George Whitesides, the whole range of approaches called soft lithography were developed. And in particular, since the interaction of thiol-terminated molecules with gold or silver or palladium is so strong, you can simply ink a stamp with a thiol, with alkyl thiol, print it on the surface, and only the area that was under the stamp would actually be functionalized with these molecules. So what we will do with that is that we will create this pattern surface, and we will, for example, make patches of one chemical character, and then to have the rest of the surface would be functionalized with yet another molecule. And to do that, let's choose the ones that we already looked at in terms of control of crystal orientation. And we know that carboxylic acid-terminated molecules are actually very active in promoting calcite nucleation and oriented growth. So if I take now the surface like that, and I have methyl-terminated background and carboxylic acid-terminated islands, you get highly localized growth of calcite only on the regions where monolayer is functionalized with carboxylic acid. This is what I wanted to achieve, but it's not really that obvious, because if I would look on a surface that is a bulk surface without patterning, that is either purely carboxylic acid terminated, and here is all these oriented crystals growing on it, and again, as we discuss, all different sizes, nothing controls that in this system. But methyl-terminated surface is not against nucleation. Nucleation there is reduced, but still it takes place. It's not oriented nucleation on this surface, but it does exist on the bulk surface. Only when they're together, you see preference only for one regions, certain regions. And the reason there is that if we think about nucleation and crystal growth, and if, let's imagine that I would have a bulk surface with just one island of certain chemistry, even though I can use concentration of the solution that is well above saturation for crystallization of this material, nucleation will take place on this region because it's more active for nucleation. Doesn't mean that the rest is not active. It's just this region is more active. So the first nuclei and the first crystal will nucleate there. And growing at this location, it would actually deplete the solution around this site such that there would be a certain region, depletion length, where the effective concentration of the solution just next to the interface is below saturation. This is actually a demonstration that this is indeed the case. If I just have one carboxylic acid-terminated island with methyl-terminated background, there is a bundle growing here, nothing around it, and then crystals begin to grow on the surface just like they do on a regular bulk methyl-terminated surface. So the rule then is such that if we choose pattern surface such that the distance between the pattern sites, between the active, more active sites, is less than double depletion length, then effective concentration of solution between these sites is always below saturation, and therefore there would be no crystal formation anywhere except on these surfaces. So one can now use this system and grow pretty much anything you want, depending which parameter you change. You can change self-assembled monolayer. This would control orientation and also crystal density. You can change the size, the concentration of calcium, for example. That would certainly change a number of crystals growing per site. And when you increase concentration too much, when the depletion, when the distance becomes larger than double depletion size, then you could see already some crystal formations between the pattern regions. But you can also take a variable as the size of your printed region. And if we look at the number of crystals that grow per site as a function of area of nucleating region, we can actually find a critical area that would only induce formation of just one crystal. And in this way, one can grow arrays of oriented crystals of any kind. Here's an array of crystals oriented in one of four orientation. Here are crystals that are affected by magnesium growing in 012 orientation with the different shapes, rice-like crystals. It doesn't have to be localized growth like that. You can use patterns, kind of inverse pattern. It could be that certain regions are actually where crystals do not grow, and you in this way create a polycrystalline array everywhere except these structures. Or again, it doesn't have to be to think about just inorganic crystals. In the last lecture, I'll talk a lot about colloidal assembly, but exactly the same approach can be used to create colloidal arrays of very specific number of particles of colloids per site, and including even one colloidal particle per site with no mistakes in this structure. And it doesn't have to be calcite. It could be semiconductor crystals. And here is a pattern semiconductor patch that can actually be grown now and potentially used directly on the device. There are other things, again, that one can do if we think about pattern growth. Let's now come back to the fact that self-assembled monolayers on gold and silver, for example, have different geometrical characteristics. In particular, tilt of the molecules on gold is much higher than on silver due to the differences in the unit cell and the size of the of gold 111 and silver 111 crystal. Which means that if now, instead of patterning self-assembled monolayers, if instead I can now pattern my substrate so that to create a region of gold, let's say, next to region of silver, although on both regions I can form the same self-assembled monolayer, meaning the same functional group, but there would be definitely, since these would have different structural parameters, the region between them would be highly would have disorder and therefore more active for nucleation than anywhere else. So the crystal will then form yet another feature, which is outlines of underlying patterns. So let's go very fast from other things. Yet another thing. We did discuss that. We can make arrays of crystals. But that guy, that again I show, is one single crystal. Entire thing is one single crystal. So can we grow large pattern single crystals? And the lesson here comes from the fact that some time ago we have shown that in many cases, not everywhere, but in many cases, very strange shapes in nature go through amorphous to crystalline transition. So it's not that the crystal will nucleate and then grow into fancy shapes. No, in many cases, it's amorphous phase that is formed first, and then at a certain moment, nucleation takes place, and this amorphous phase transforms into crystalline. We do know which molecules are in charge or responsible for amorphous material formation in nature. If we use them in synthetic system, they induce amorphous calcium carbonate instead of those that are extracted from crystalline calcium carbonate materials. So if now we take this lesson and functionalize our surface with molecules that are known to induce amorphous material formation, what happens then, and here's one example, it first forms amorphous blobs, but then even under the electron beam, you could see that this amorphous lava is moving into formation of crystals in different places. But you can take it further and design it in the following way. What if we take a substrate, let's say gold substrate, I want it to be oriented. I don't want it to be polycrystalline. So I'll put a small nucleation site that, let's say carboxylic acid terminated or something like that. The rest of the surface, I can functionalize with molecules that induce amorphous material formation. I can impose on top of that a certain structure, whatever the shape that I want my crystals to have at the end, and then put it in the calcium carbonate solution. So everywhere, nucleation takes place, so there is induction time for nucleation. So the first phase that is forming is amorphous calcium carbonate, and then at a certain moment, nucleation is induced, and crystal propagates through the entire structure and forms a micropattern single crystal. And indeed, we were able to show that we can form, for example, this one is perforated crystal. You could see that it's single crystal. And there was a beautiful work from Uli Steiners taking this even further and making very nice pattern single crystals that are templated by a available space in which these crystals can grow. So we can control polymorphism, we can do more, and more means, and we'll have two lectures on hydrophobicity and superhydrophobicity. So the only thing I want to say now is that if we have hydrophobic surfaces with micro and nanostructures, they become superhydrophobic, which means that liquid is beating up into almost 180 degrees contact angles, and liquid is only touching the tips of these structures. So why not to use these tips now as a 2.5D pattern substrate? Instead of putting a chemistry, as I've shown you before, why not to grow crystals selectively at the tips of these superhydrophobic substrates? And here is an example with calcite. This is a top view of an array of high aspect ratio posts. And depending on concentration of calcium that we use or time, you could see the beginning of forming these nice spherical deposits on top of these structures. And you can, since they're far from each other, austral ripening is not affecting this system much, so they all begin to nucleate at the same time, grow to the same sizes, and since they are attached to very small point of these high aspect ratio structures, their adhesion to the substrate is very, very weak. So it's very easy to collect them and to get, look at these beautiful spherical crystalline or sometimes non-crystalline deposits that you can create nanoparticles of interesting shapes and remove them from the surface in pretty much easily. Honestly, it's very difficult to keep them on the surface. Any transition from going through air-water interface creates sufficient force to pick them up, and you just get your yield of highly uniform particles. So let me spend now 5, maybe 10 minutes on really fancy things. Now, I was talking that we can use particles or crystal growth modifiers that interact with different parts of the crystal. But if they interact with the crystal, they would still interact uniformly with crystallographically related identical facets. So it's not that you can achieve every possible shape by purely specific crystallographic interaction between the additive and the crystal. It will still have some crystallographic shape, the shape that corresponds to crystallography of the crystal. But what if I look back, and now I'm putting on this slide not only carbonates, but also silica, and a lot of organisms build their skeleton not from calcium carbonate, but actually from silica, from glass. And if we look again, and I put even more examples, so here is the examples of carbonates, calcium carbonates, as skeletal elements in nature. Here's an example, I've shown you that in the first lecture, but here's another one. This is biosilica. These shapes are amazing. Purely by thinking about surface control, unlikely that we can do that. And what we were able to do, really to make arrays of these crystals, some bundles of crystals. Kroeger and Merz have shown that if you extract proteins from these biosilicas, you can form nice silica spheres. Again, primitive shapes, but nice thing here is that they were able to grow silica at glass at room temperature without going to 200 degrees C. Let me add another feature that I want to introduce in this crystal design concept. Let's talk about reaction diffusion systems, and that's yet another thing that is important to understand. In nature, there is almost nothing in equilibrium. Diffusion is always there. Changes in chemical gradients, always there. So what is it that we can think of? And in particular, if we look at beautiful results where reaction diffusion was shown either by Alan Turing or by Boris Belousov, where the patterns begin to form as a function of diffusion and, most importantly, feedback loops in these systems. So let's come back to carbonates, but add silica, and there's always silica in the ocean at least, but let's do it in a very simple experiment. Let now put in the solution calcium or barium or strontium, divalent iron, but also liquid glass, and place it in this way and just simply wait for CO2 to diffuse into this beaker, and CO2 with calcium or barium or strontium will form carbonate deposit, and something else would be happening here. And in particular, there would be an interesting feedback system where there would be a field of changing chemical gradients, there would be competition of growth and passivation. What happens in this system is that as CO2 is coming into that, and the environment is highly basic. Then it would form HCO3, which then would deposit barium carbonate. But as it will deposit barium carbonate, it produces proton. So the environment is becoming more and more acidic as more and more barium carbonate, strontium carbonate, or calcium carbonate is forming. Constantly more and more acidic. At the same time, if you look at the liquid glass, in acidic environment, it forms silicic acid, and then polycondensation takes place, and it will form silica. Now, if you look on both processes, and what I'm showing here in black is the as a function of pH, the growth rate of silica, and in red is a function of pH, growth rate of barium carbonate, then depending where you begin your experiment, interesting things may happen. Most uninteresting are here. If I choose pH of the solution that is below the silica deposition range, then silica will never form. There would be purely carbonate forming in the system. pH will go down, 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 and that's not interesting at all. However, let's take a look what happens if we're here. So in this moment, no silica formation, only silica starts here. So at this pH, only carbonate can form, but as it's forming, pH is being reduced. It hits the silica deposition range, and at this moment, silica begins to form on top of carbonate. However, this solution is basic. It cannot grow carbonate anymore because this is value of death. It will overgrow by silica here. So what happens in this case is that the crystals begin to grow towards the solution, towards higher pH value where silica cannot deposit. So you would have actually chemotaxis of your structures that would go towards solution and again reducing pH, and the cycle of deposition of barium carbonate and silica will create structures whose shapes would depend on nucleation density. And the beauty of the system that we have, especially when it's oriented like that in this beaker, is that concentration of CO2 as a function of depth in your beaker is different. So you have more CO2 on the top, you have high density of nucleation, you grow just stems in this region. Where you have a little bit lower density of nucleation, they begin to form conical structures. And where they are very low density of nucleation, they form these coral-like structures. We know exactly why and how they do it. We know that it's interaction between carbonate and silica feedback system that changes pH and goes through the cyclic oscillating reaction that makes these beautiful structures. Here's in the interface between those that form coral-like and these, whatever you can call them, but beautiful vases. The reason it happens is that silica that is depositing is always depositing on the side. The tips of these structures continue growing, and if you're in regime one, they will grow towards solution, trying to escape the lower pH environment. And in this way, these structures begin to develop. There are other things that you can play with. The fact that there is a controlled wall thickening in your system I can play with CO2 concentration. I can give a flux of CO2 by simply opening and closing the lid in your structure. What happens then is that you suddenly increase concentration of CO2 when you have this increased flux. The wall at that location would be a little bit wider, but then I will close again and it comes back to the specific wall thickness that is defined by the concentrations and the diffusion gradients in your environment. What it means that we can play with that, and let's say to do the Morse code in these structures. So these flowers or gardening on the nanoscale, so I'll call them flowers. These are not exactly like flowers, but these ripples on the wall was made by us by simply opening and closing the lid. And in this particular case, it says all the structures in these places would have the right number of ripples. And in this case, it's hello. There are other things that you can do. You can start the structure, and if you increase concentration significantly, or you change the ion, you change, say, barium carbonate to strontium carbonate that has a very different solubility, then the only option for it to keep the constant wall size is to split the wall. So what happens here is these structures were grown as barium carbonate structures, and at a certain moment, solution was changed from barium to strontium, and suddenly you could see formation of nice flowers on top of them. And you actually can see that before strontium was added, they all looked like 1D structures. You can play with temperature, you can play with salt, and all that would change your reaction kinetics and therefore sizes and shapes of the structures that can form. Now, another regime is if we start very close to silica deposition rate. Since barium carbonate is forming much faster than silica, very fast reduces pH and finds itself on the other side of this curve, which means that these crystals, or these structures, would not have positive chemotaxis. It would be negative chemotaxis. They do not want to grow towards high pH solution because they go to silica deposition, and silica will suppress further growth. It will encase the crystals. So the only way for them to continue growing is to grow towards lower pH regions. And lower pH regions means to grow towards its own exhaust. It means to turn away from the bulk solution. And the outcome of that is actually growing spirals of different kind. And depending where we begin, we can controllably form either spirals, double spirals, single spirals, or they simply leaves that do not grow towards the solution and try to stay away from the bulk by creating silica overlay on top and continuing growing carbonate along the substrate. So all that is possible. It's just a nice structure that actually has all different types of structures in them. And let me finish with very fast showing that we can play with that. And these structures do not appear without our control. Now we know why they grow. We know where to start. We know what to do, either to change temperature suddenly that changes, for example, solubility as a function of temperature. Immediately, walls will begin thicker or thinner, and so on. And one example is, let's say we begin at 1 pH, and we just simply change pH while growing the system. So on top of these spirals that we're growing in the lower pH solution, now we're entering the regime of growing coral-like structures. So these kind of interesting things can form. And of course, this is color de Siem, but in fact, this is what is going on. Because here, what you can see, this particular structure, which is color de Siem, but this is confocal microscopy. We were growing the green part with fluorescein marker, and then we added the rhodamine when we were growing these flowers on top. And you could see that green is separate from red. So only specific tips are active and growing in these systems. You can do it by pH, as I've shown you here. You can do it by varying the compounds. So going from barium to strontium and growing, let's say, irises in this case. You can do it by temperature. So you can begin at 20 degrees C, and that corresponds to growth of these bundles of 1D structures, and then changing temperature to lower temperature and adding actually rhodamine B, and you can form nice bundles of stems with tulips on top. And we can play with anything we want by maybe even simply changing orientation of your substrate. We know that it changes density and type of structure. So let's say I put it in one direction, and then I on top put it on another direction. Just change it. And then I can have this type of, and say, what will grow if I change it from here to here, from here to there? And if I just go from the same to same, it will form that. If I go from stems to 3D structures, it will form something like roses. And if we go and think about even more complexity, this is coccolith structures with trumpets. And we can make them because we know how to make this. And here is one structure. Then we know how out of that suddenly grow single 1D structures and then how to split them by changing either concentration or changing from barium to calcium. And all of them will grow in this way. And I can show you many more of these beautiful structures, but I want to finish with saying that we have mathematical modeling of these structures growing, and together with Professor Mahadevan, we developed a full mathematical theory of why and how, as a function of pH, as a function of conditions and local diffusion gradients, how different shapes are developed. And we just, a month ago, I think we published papers showing the growth of pretty much every structure we have. But even more interestingly, it's not only that modeling shown the structures that we have already observed experimentally. Even more interestingly are the ones that are here and here that show that we have never seen structures of that kind in our experiments. We certainly haven't seen structures of that kind in our experiment. And from mathematical modeling, an interesting in the phase diagram of conditions, we were given a recipe to grow them. And why we were interested? Because, not for beauty of it, because these two structures actually were described as beam splitters and optically, photonically important materials that is almost impossible to make by lithography. So we were, from theory, we actually were able to grow these structures. But not only that, since we can grow them and we know how they grow, we can actually put a certain light source in the nucleus before it will grow into whatever we want to grow. And what we see that indeed these structures have optical properties. They do guide light, just like the structures that were predicted, for example, these photonic trumpets or these beam splitters that can actually be now used as optical elements. So with that, I want to thank you. I certainly want to thank my students and postdocs working on this topic, and my collaborators, my former PhD actually advisors, Leah Dyde and Steve Weiner, George Whitesize, and Professor Mahadevan. And while I keep that for the next lecture, I would be happy to take your questions.